Dallas Mayberry Commerce. Let the record reflect, it is 3:30. It's Friday, March 27, 2009. We have Representative Lynn Boop, Chenault Newman, Olson and Holmes are excused, and I think the Coghill is up in finance. We do have a quorum. Today we're going to hear House Bill 151 and act relating to use regulation, operation of belts, and maybe 105, or at least some presentation by his staff and HJR 16. You may have noticed that House Bill 37 and 85, we scheduled them. We wanted to make sure that they were recognized. We can bring them back as bills that were scheduled in. First off, House Bill, well, we're not going to be taking testimony today on 37 and 185, so if you're here for that one, hope you enjoy the other ones. House Bill 151, I'm going to have my staff, Jim Ellis, come on up and explain the bill briefly, Jim. But first we need to adopt we've got a CS on this one. Representative Chenault, would you offer that?
Mr. Chairman, I make a motion to adopt before the committee the work draft 26-LS0422/E Kane as a document before the committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, mine says C.
Okay, we'll make sure you get it.
You're on the wrong bill.
You're drawing church, but the wrong pew. The right pew, but the wrong church.
Should be the first one.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ellis.
The chair and committee members, my name is Jim Ellis. I am staff representative Mark Newman. I'm here to present HB 151, the act repealing termination date, but as you see, the CS that we're considering would merely extend that sunset date. With that said, I'll go and discuss what the substance of the bill and the program, what it does. The bill quite simply changes the sunset, extends it for 8 years in the future, which will continue the program unchanged for 8 years. A bit about the program, it's been a safety program that helps with education, boating safety, and other efforts. You may have seen the Kids Don't Float life jackets that are at many different boat launches around the state. That's part of that program. Since the year 2000, it's helped reduce boating-related deaths in Alaska by 20%. And in addition, we've also seen an increase in Alaskans observing safe boating practices. One reason you may notice that the termination date is 2010, we're actually trying to get it extended more quickly due to federal funding. If we don't, they cannot apply for a full year if the program will terminate in half a year. So if we extend it now, it'll allow the Department of Natural Resources to receive a full year funding. That said, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Ross? Thank you, Jim. We do have a couple of people who would like to speak to this today. James King, who's the Director of State Parks. This falls under James' purview. James, are you available?
Yes, I'm here.
Name and affiliation, please.
My name is James King, and I'm the director of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation.
Go ahead, James.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. If I could just spend a couple of minutes hitting some of the highlights of this program. As Jim mentioned, Kids Don't Float Life Jacket Loaner Program is a major piece of this program. There are 515 of these loaner boards around the state, 153 different communities. And the Boating Safety Program is the major supplier of the life jackets for that those loaner boats. The Kids Don't Float program also has an educational component, teaching boating safety programs to up-to-date over 63,000 students in Alaska. Alaska WaterWise is a popular program, a training program of this, of the Boating Safety Program as well, that helps teach boaters wise boating practices. Marketing is also an important part of this program, sharing boating safety messages on radio, television, and other media. Alaska Boaters Handbook is one of those. The Cold Water Boating Video is another one, which has received national recognition and used in a lot of training with agencies and other organizations. The program also trains law enforcement, state troopers, and others in safe boating practices and law enforcement practices. They also provide support to the U.S. Coast Guard Auxiliary Vessel Safety Check Program. And I think one of the most exciting things about this program is there are 17 Alaskan children that are alive today thanks to Kids Don't Float life jackets. They've been rescued from the water wearing those life jackets. The other important thing to note is that since this program started nearly 10 years ago, life jacket wear rates have gone up significantly, and as Jim pointed out, recreational boating fatalities have gone down significantly, 20%. It's a great program. We've seen a lot of success, and we're excited to see it go into the future and appreciate your efforts in considering this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Director King. Any questions for the director? Thank you, Director King. Oh, we did have Representative Lynn.
Well, I'm just curious on these PFDs, or life jackets, what I used to call them. I think it's a wonderful program. How many of those do you actually lose?
Through the chair, Representative Wynn, you know, life jackets wear out. Some get stolen, others get lost. But relatively small. What we found is people are pretty responsible with those life jackets, that they do appreciate being able to borrow them, and for the most part, they put them back on the boards. And we get, you know, people who will donate jackets to the boards, and the program has been pretty amazing that way. And when they do wear out, that's the exciting thing about having this program, is we don't hesitate to throw the old ones away and get some new ones that are safe and will help protect the kids. So it's been very successful that way, and I don't think we've lost all that many.
I just think that's a wonderful program. But who did you say provides those? I missed that.
And James, could you back up from the microphone a little bit?
Okay.
Yep.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, those life jackets are all provided through this program. They come from the federal funding that pays for this program, pays for all of those life jackets.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Director. Any more questions? Thank you, James.
Now
we do have somebody who knows a little bit about this bill. The former sponsor of the original bill, Mr. Representative Bill Hudson. Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Speaker, good to see you. Gentlemen. Mr. Chairman, I'm here to, I was hoping I would be able to testify on the original bill. I believe on a 90-day session, folks should have more important things to do than to constantly do some of these sunset provisions for something that's been so successful. However, what you do have before you is, in my opinion, very necessary and should be pretty much a matter of course. I've followed the program since I first introduced it, and of course, I spent 20-some-odd years of my life in the Coast Guard, and much of my activity was out there saving people who, in many cases, were unfamiliar with how to protect themselves in the water it is a different environment altogether. And since we've had this program, as my following at any rate, it has saved lives directly, and it, I think indirectly, has probably saved many, many more. So, Mr. Chairman, I compliment you for introducing this sponsor substitute and this legislation to extend it on another 8 years here. And if you have any questions of me, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. And just a brief comment on that is we had the original bill we had, we were going to eliminate the sunset date. But I know that I've talked to other members of the legislature and they had concerns. They like to make sure that these sunset dates are in place so that they can come back in front of the legislature because these programs are our responsibility. And it's just a way for us to check up on them. It doesn't hurt for us to get refreshed on the issues either. So that's was the reason that we did that.
I agree with that, and I've certainly heard that argument when we first introduced it. But anyway, congratulations on introducing, and I hope you would pass this bill.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Representative Hudson. Mike Volkers?
Good afternoon. I'd like to read a short prepared statement here. Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen.
Mr. Folkers, can you please identify yourself and affiliation?
My name is Michael Folkerts. I'm the Recreational Boating Safety Specialist for the U.S. Coast Guard. It's a pleasure to appear before you today to discuss the National Recreational Boating Safety Program. The Coast Guard, through the Secretary of Homeland Security, is directed to carry out a National Recreational Boating Safety Program under Chapter 131 of Title 46 United States Code. The goal of the program is to encourage the states to assume the major role in carrying out boating safety education, assistance, and enforcement activities within their jurisdictions and to foster greater development, use, and enjoyment of all waters of the United States. Under this program, the Coast Guard allocates and distributes funds to eligible states to assist them in developing, carrying out, and financing state recreational boating safety programs. Federal financial assistance to the states is provided through the Boating Safety Account of the Aquatic Resources Trust Fund, also known as the Sport Fish Restoration and Boating Trust Fund. Part of that eligibility requirement to receive this funding was achieved when Alaska established its Boating Safety and Education Program by passing House Bill 108, an act relating to boating safety in 2000. Alaska's Boating Safety Program has now been in place for nearly 10 years. Recreational boaters are safer and better educated. Recreational boating fatalities are on a downward trend. The five-year fatality rate averaged 23.8 lives lost per year from 1995 to 1999. Our most recent five-year average from 2004 to 2008 is only 15.8 lives lost per year. In calendar year 2008, we lost 12 Alaskans in recreational boating accidents, the lowest number since the program began. Continuation Alaska Boating Safety Program would help save lives. The United States Coast Guard will continue to maintain a strong working relationship with the state of Alaska, as outlined in a memorandum of understanding between the state and the Coast Guard. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today, and I'll be glad to answer any questions you may have regarding the Coast Guard and boating safety in Alaska.
Any questions for Mr. Folkers? Thank you. And the committee is very fortunate to have a distinguished guest in the audience. If you haven't noticed, the gentleman there with all the brass on his chest there with Admiral Brooks. So welcome, Admiral.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee, I'm Admiral Gene Brooks, Arthur Eugene Brooks. I'm commander of the 17th Coast Guard District, responsible for all Coast Guard operations in Alaska. And I'd just like to make a few brief remarks, opening with the thought, the deadliest catch in Alaska is not on commercial fishing vessels. The deadliest catch is on recreational pleasure boats. We have more deaths on recreational boats than on commercial fishing vessels every year. And your program, the State Boating Safety Program, has done a tremendous job in reducing the loss of life on recreational pleasure boats, almost exclusively, but substantially on state waters. We've talked about the loss of fatalities, the Kids Don't Float programs statewide. And when I first heard the term Kids Don't Float, I thought it was fairly harsh, but it's true. And you know, when they told me they put life jackets in lockers and left them unprotected, I said, how does that last more than a week? But you know, people don't steal those, and they actually refill them. It's really been an amazing program that has truly worked in Alaska. The no violation boardings have increased from 35% in 2001 to 73%. I mean, 73% of the boats that we do courtesy inspections on for boating safety are now in full compliance with the boating safety requirements. Three out of every four boats have all the required safety equipment on board. And so I'm here to say that this has been a great partnership for the Coast Guard. I think it's great for Alaskans, and I encourage your support for this bill.
Thank you. Admiral, any questions? Thank you, committee members. Is there anybody else in the audience who'd like to speak?
Yes, this is Chuck Ewan up in Fairbanks, Alaska. I'd like to make a comment about supporting this bill.
Okay, Chuck, we're gonna go off net here while we got you online then. Please, Chuck.
Okay. Yeah, I've been on the Yukon River since the mid-90s and watching these folks up there in the villages getting out on their boats and loading them up and taking their kids with them, and there's maybe about 2 or 3 inches of freeboard on the side of the boat, and nobody's got a life jacket even in the boat. And in 2000, this program went into effect, and the life jackets disappeared off the board, and you still wouldn't see them. And then, but the next year, when I was up there in 2001, people were using them. Kids that had them out there, and they were using them on the boats, and they've been using them ever since. And I'd like to see this program continue. My only complaint that I have against the bill as it is right now is the sunset clause, but I understand what you're saying about revisiting it in 8 more years, but I prefer it didn't have one. That's my comment.
Thank you, Mr. Goodwin. Do you have any questions? Thank you. We'll go back to Juno here. We did have somebody from the audience.
I'm Tim Bundy. I'm the Chief of Intervention Emergency Medical Services out of Public Health, Division of Health and Social Services. And I'd like to make some comments today, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Tim.
House Bill 151, which initially repealed the sunset, I hadn't seen the new amendment that you made, but when we looked at that, the Act essentially does four things. It makes boating laws consistent with federal laws. It assigns boating regulation functions to appropriate state agencies. It qualifies Alaska to receive state share of grant funds, and it creates a safe boating education program for Alaska. It's in my section that we house the Kids Don't Float program and work in partnership with everybody in the state. Since 1991 in Alaska, there's been 271 commercial boating fatalities and 383 non-commercial boating fatalities. According to the Bureau of Vital Statistics, the Alaska Bureau of Vital Statistics, drowning was the sixth leading cause of death due to fatal injuries in Alaska from 2002 to 2006. Based on a previous study in death on water analysis of non-commercial boating fatalities in Alaska in 1991 and 2000, and this was by Susan Hargis, who was a recreation boating specialist intern with U.S. Coast Guard. Drowning data indicated that where victims were found, 9 out of the 10 of the boats were under 26 feet, 9 out of the 10 were adult males, 5 of the 6 boats involved were dealing with either capsized or overboard. 3 of the 4 of them were power boats. It was split 50-50 in terms of whether it was on freshwater or saltwater, and about 25% of those alcohol was confirmed afterwards as a contributing factor. Since the Safe Boating Act was enacted by the 21st legislature, programs documented greater than 20% reductions in fatalities by water transports in Alaska. Additionally, the Kids on Float program, managed by the Department of Human Health Services in partnership with Department of Natural Resources, U.S. Coast Guard Auxiliary, Safe Kids, Alaska Native Tribal Consortium, and numerous other local and organizations, state agencies, we have documented the 17 children lives saved through the use of these children loaner life jackets. The Kids Don't Float program has been adopted and promoted by Safe Kids International, Safe Kids of America. This program was a model program recipient of an outstanding achievement award by the National Freshwater Fisheries Hall of Fame in 2006. Prior to 2000, the state did not have a Safe Boating Act, and federal funds that were collected from Alaskans under the Federal Sport Fish Restoration and Boating Trust Funds were given to other states. And since the Alaska Boating Act was enacted by the 21st letter, the state has received approximately $1.1 million per year in federal revenue, and at least on average about $450,000 in boat registration receipts that would have gone to other states had we not enacted this act. The money received through the programs funds numerous boating safety programs, including include the purchase of the life vest for the Kids Don't Float program for the 515 station, which, by the way, that's about $60,000 a year to do all the replacements for the number of stations we have now. If the Safe Boating Act was allowed to set and set, we would lose the federal funding and we wouldn't have the ability to fund programs like Kids Don't Float. And I'm sure other water and safety programs would be affected, such as those by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association and Coast Guard Auxiliary, Alaska Tribal Native Tribal Health Consortium, and Alaska Safe Kids. I want to thank you for the moment to give.
Thank you, Mr. Bundy. Do we have any questions? Thank you. Anybody else in the audience? Hearing and seeing none, public testimony is closed. Do we have any committee comments? What's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, if you would like, I would like to move CS for House Bill 151-26-LS-0422-EK out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, that bill will move from committee. We'll take a slight at ease.
Good to see you, Mike.
Next up, we have House Bill 105. We have heard this before. I think we've had some testimony. We do have Representative Coghill staff, Reneva, here. So, Reneva, you know the drill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Reneva Moss, staff to Representative Coghill. I think all of you remember this bill from last year. It was House Bill 226. It was an attempt to... The STEP program was up for sunset. Representative Coghill had a bill, House Bill 226, that would have made it permanent, eliminate the sunset. And there was some discussion about some changes in the program. The Senate passed the bill with a two-year sunset and instructions for the department to look at forming a work group of people from all sectors of the workforce to come up with recommendations on how to improve the program, make it more user-friendly and more accountable. Before this bill even passed, Commissioner Cliff Bishop appointed a task force of people who included representatives from the trade unions and from private sector. They have met several times, and you will have two members of the Alaska Workforce Investment Committee testify today on the process, as well as David Stone, who has put a lot of work into this. So what you see here, and there is a CS, Mr. Chairman, that Representative Coghill would like adopted. It is version C, and that's the version that I would like to talk to, if that is okay, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Renee, but I don't see that in our packet. Okay, I see a... Okay, we do have a CS. P is in...
C is in cap. Yeah. Karen will give you a copy of it.
I have C version. Well, can we move... Can we move without a quorum?
Mr. Chairman, you can adopt amendments with three members. You cannot pass a bill out without three.
Well, we can make, okay, I'll move the CS if you like. Mr. Chair, I would move CS for House Bill number 105-26-LS-0475-C with... attached fiscal note, there is one.
Thank you, Representative Lynn.
And Mr. Chairman, what this bill does is it gives the Alaska Workforce Investment Board more say in how the STEP, or the State Training and Employment Program, is run. It expands their duties to include review and approval of regulations to be adopted by the Department of Labor as far as the operations of STEP, and they will annually review and approve the STEP priorities that are set by the department. To us, it's a bill that makes the STEP program less of a nightmare, and I should say it eliminates the nightmare factor of STEP as far as paperwork. And we have talked to people on both sides of the track. I even had one gentleman say, he said, the grant process is cruel to business. And that wasn't a degrading remark for the department. It was just that the bureaucracy was more than what he wanted to go through in order to be able to get STEP money for the training of his employees. But Representative Coghill is very pleased with what has happened in the last year. And because of that, he is sponsoring a bill that would make STEP a permanent program, and it would make the Alaska Workforce Investment Board a partner with the Department of Labor in making sure that the training that is going on is training in areas that we need. I think all of us are anxiously awaiting a gas line, but Alaska needs to be ready for that gas line, and we feel like STEP is a mechanism for some of that training to go on. So what I'm going to do, Mr. Chairman, if it's okay with you, is I'm going to have David Stone come up and explain the STEP program, and then we're going to have two people who I hope are online. Do we have people online?
Yes, we do have one.
Okay.
But, Maneva, we do have a question from Representative Book for you.
Sure.
Through the Chair, Chief of Staff Moss, the changes that you went over today, are they the substantive changes that we saw compared to the bill that we looked at last year? I mean, was it last year or 2 years ago when we started going over this issue?
Through the Chair, Representative Book, it was 2 years ago that we introduced House Bill 226. And the purpose of that bill basically was to end the sunset provision and make it a permanent program. Because of some of the discussion about the program, the legislature felt that Department of Labor should look at the program and see if there was ways to make it more user-friendly, which they have done. The Alaska Workforce Investment Board will have more of a say in not only regulations that will install, for instance, an appeal process that is workable. If a person's grant is denied, they will have the ability to appeal that decision in a timely manner. So this is the product of a review that the legislature asked the Department of Labor to do, and the House Bill 226 was even specific in saying that they wanted the department and the task force to come back with recommendations to change the program.
Through the Chair.
Representative Book.
Really appreciate your endeavors in all of this regard. The two-year process, it was pretty agonizing, and I realize that it took a huge component of the efforts from the Rules Chair and his staff, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Reneva. Any more questions? David Stone.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm David Stone, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. I also serve on the Alaska Workforce Investment Board and also co-chair of the STEP Task Force. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Coghill and his staff for introducing House Bill 105 this year and also sponsoring STEP legislation and working so diligently in previous years. The STEP Task Force was created in legislation that passed last year. The task force was required to develop recommendations for revisions to statutes and regulations to improve the program. This legislation before you today, Draft Committee Substitute House Bill 105, is a result of the recommendations from the task force. The report was sent to the legislature in February. Task force is composed of 10 people representing the employers, employees, the U.S. Department of Labor, the university, and the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. Task force has met numerous times since the spring of last year. The recommendations from the task force include the following: offering services to an expanded pool of workers who may be displaced, clarifying the Alaska Workforce Investment Board's oversight and accountability, supporting resident hire through targeted projects and services, increasing input from local businesses and regional advisory councils, streamlining the grantee application and reporting process, and make STEP a permanent program. Just a few facts about STEP. The department's research and analysis section tracks STEP participants for a full year after training to accurately evaluate the program. In 2007, the latest year for which figures are available, STEP participants earned more than $62 million in Alaska wages in the year following their training. In other words, this represents an average salary increase of almost 18%. The 1,445 participants who exited STEP in 2007 increased their earnings by $9.3 million. 91% of the participants claimed Alaska residency for their permanent fund dividend in 2008. 95% of STEP participants were employed within 12 months. To close, quite simply, STEP works. It consistently is the best training program for Alaskans seeking training as unemployed or underemployed workers. By reducing the length of time that workers are unemployed, this program is designed to reduce the amount of unemployment insurance benefits that are paid. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Dunn, Representative Boo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you give the committee a list of those board members and their particular affiliations?
I'll try to give you the list. Ginger Blaisdell, who was at the time Senate President Lida Green's staffer, was on it and very knowledgeable about STEP.
Which board were you looking for?
You're talking about the task force. Is that correct?
Well, I'm
the Workforce Investment Board.
The Workforce Investment Board.
Oh, the Workforce Investment Board is, it's made up of, I think it's 25 people, including commissioners of education, labor, commerce, as well as the broad geography of folks. Linda Hulbert, who's with the New York Life, Doug Ward with Ketchikan Shipyard. We have people, operating engineers, we have people from various different labor folks that are involved. It's a huge group. Jim Lynch is the chair, who is with Fairbanks Hospital. It's a very active board. I've actually served on that board for many years until I became deputy commissioner.
Okay. Representative Boop.
Well, part of your statements was that you said you've streamlined the process. And now that you have over 24 people on this board, I know by committee that that doesn't necessarily make things streamlined, but I'm just kind of curious how this all works so that in the end we give the benefit to those people who are seeking these grants.
What we've set up is a process where...
Please direct questions to the chair.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, through the chair. We've set up a process where three people from the Workforce Investment Board would look at all competitive grant applications. They would make, and there would be one person from the outside, a member of the public, they would review the grant applications and they would make the decisions on who would be awarded those grants. If there were any discretionary funds left over, there would be two members of the Workforce Investment Board meeting with a commissioner looking at those discretionary grants. So it wouldn't be the whole board, it wouldn't be so onerous. The whole idea is to make it fast, make it nimble, and make it responsive.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Boak. And there is a makeup of the committee that worked on this in your packet. Any other questions for Mr. Stone? Thank you. We do have any other members of the room? Don?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Don Etheridge. I represent the Alaska AFL-CIO and also the Alaska Workforce Partnership. And both our organizations support the legislation. We support the program. It's been very good program to reach to a lot of our rural areas that would be left out of the training without that abilities to be able to take instructors out there to or bring them in to the larger communities where the training happens. So we're fully supportive of this program and would like to see it continue.
Thank you, Don. Any questions? We have Linda Holbert, who is...
Muted. Unmuted.
Linda?
Muted.
Linda Holbert?
Yes, this is Linda Holbert. I apologize for calling you. I'm in the middle of the SeaTac airport on my way back home to Fairbanks and glad to get a flight. I have lived in Fairbanks for the last 40 years, and I've been active in workforce development since 1983.
Linda, are you
representing
yourself? I work
in the private sector as an agent with New York Life Insurance, and I'd very much like to support the state training and employment program. I've been a part of this program for many years, and I've watched it grow, and I've watched it serve many, many Alaskans. I have served on the Alaska Workforce Board the last few years, and I have had the opportunity to serve as well on the STEP Task Force, taking a look at the program as it was in the past and reforming it to meet the state's needs today. I would like to support this bill. It's critical. It's very important to be able to have a flexible and trained workforce. This is key funding to provide that across the state, both to individuals and groups, to move people in priority training areas into successful jobs, ones that reflect a living wage for their families. I'd be glad to entertain any questions you may have, but I strongly support the STEP legislation. It's really critical that we have this for the future and that we don't have it sunset every couple years. It's a lot of time and effort for the legislature, and it's very hard to plan a program just for a year or two. We need ongoing, continuing support that we can provide good training to good jobs for Alaska workers. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today, and I hope that you could hear me.
Thank you, Linda. Linda, were you representing yourself? Thank you. I think she's on the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. Did you have questions? Thank you. Now, next we have Doug Ward. Doug from Ketchikan. Doug, are you available? Doug Ward at Ketchikan LIO.
Might be unmuted.
Thank you. Maybe Doug had some, probably had to get back to work building boats. Building a new ferry for Mansu.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Is this Ketchikan LIO? Thank you. That's fine. Doug was probably going to talk in support of this.
I see he's trying to speak.
We got a technical problem. We'll take an Andes. Doug Ward, are you available?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
All right, we got you. Doug, would you like to speak on House Bill 105?
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. As you said, my name is Doug Ward, and I am the Director of Shipyard Development for Alaska Ship and Dry Dock. We're an Alaska corporation operating the Ketchikan Shipyard under a 30-year agreement with the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. I'm a member of the Alaska Workforce Investment Board, chairing the Workforce Readiness and Employment Placement Committee, and also a member of Commissioner Bishop's STEP Task Force. Alaska Ship and Dry Dock is a current STEP grant recipient, accessing the STEP grant program to develop a stable, knowledgeable, and skilled shipyard workforce capable of reducing the cost of building and repairing ferries and ships that operate in Alaska. I'm here today to support the committee substitute version C of House Bill 105, and as you consider the substitute for HB 105, please keep in mind that the Workforce Investment Board was tasked by Commissioner Bishop in 2007 to reassume and execute its statutory authority and fiduciary responsibilities to provide effective oversight of the state's workforce investment initiatives. Since then, the commissioner has provided the leadership necessary for the board to accomplish this task, and I'm happy to report the board has literally transformed itself to a hardworking, sleeves-up group of people that are developing the tools and policies that Alaska needs to provide maximum resident employment in existing and emerging careers. And I emphasize careers in Alaska, not just jobs. I've also had the pleasure to sit on Commissioner STEP Task Force, and I want to thank Deputy Commissioner David Stone for his enthusiastic leadership there and strong leadership to get to the recommendations that were contained in the STEP Task Force report conveyed to you earlier. These are our task force recommendations for House Bill 1 that are included in House Bill 105 that you're considering today. Of the many task forces and committees that I've sat on over the years, this STEP task force has been one of the most productive of them all, particularly when you consider the diverse interests represented by the commissioner's appointments: the University of Alaska, organized labor, employers, legislative staff, and federal workforce professionals. During the course of the year's deliberation, something truly remarkable occurred within this group. Not only were this group, diverse group of individuals able to identify common issues and develop mutually agreeable solutions, but at the end of the day, the entire task force was unanimous in its support for the task force report and the language contained in the committee substitute House Bill 105 that you're considering. The STEP program has been successful in training Alaskans for good careers. This House Bill 105 provides statutory equality for all potential STEP grant recipients and participants and provides the statutory authority necessary for the STEP task force to proceed on with the important work of revising the STEP policies and regulations that will streamline the STEP program, make it an even more valuable tool in developing legacy careers for Alaskans. Thank you for this time today, and I urge you to vote yes on HB 105 when that vote comes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Doug. Do we have any questions for Doug Ward? Thank you, Doug. Anybody else in the public that would like to speak, either online or in the audience? Can you now close public testimony? Any discussion from the committee? Representative Lynn?
No, I just, well, no, are we going to try to move the bill or get somebody in there where we can?
We, Representative Coghill is up in House Finance, so I think if there's no objection, we'll probably set this aside for right now. We'll hear from Representative Gatto's staff, and then hopefully we'll be able to get Representative Coghill down here shortly, and if it's the will of this committee at that time, we'll move the bill. So for now, we will set 105 aside and take up House Joint Resolution 16 by Representative Gatto and staff.
All right, for the record, my name is Sandra Wilson. I am staff to Representative Gatto. HJR 16 recognizes the sacrifices of the men and women who make up our military. They sacrificed the opportunity to start a small business in order to protect our country. HJR 16 asked that federal agencies set aside 3% of federal procurement for service-disabled veteran-owned businesses. There are currently two separate pieces of legislation that were passed by Congress that asks or that mandates 3% of federal procurement contracts be set aside for service-disabled veteran-owned businesses, and there is also a presidential order mandating that federal agencies do the same thing. The resolution would ask that federal agencies in Alaska follow the 3% procurement mandate, as well as ask Congress to look into why it's not being followed nationwide.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. We have any questions for Ms. Wilson?
I do.
All right. I had some discussion with some folks earlier. Does this allow a disabled veteran to become a partner with a large business and get an advantage on construction contracts?
If the business is owned by a veteran who's been a service-disabled veteran, it can't just be one partner in the business. It has to be a majority share of the business's own. And in the case of a large business, it would be 51% of those workers would also have to be service-disabled veterans.
So I'm sure. So if you had a disabled veteran who owned his company, can he partner with XYZ construction company that has 300 employees and get an advantage or a 3%?
Under your scenario, he would not qualify as a veteran disabled or service disabled veteran-owned business. Under set out in the federal mandates in the legislation that they passed, if it is a large company such as the one that you're in the scenario, if a company has 300 employees, the only service disabled person is the owner, they would not qualify.
So 50% of the employees on the job site have to be disabled veterans?
In a large business, is my understanding, and there are a couple of people online who may be able to better answer the question.
Or any business?
Correct.
So if a company was going to bid on a contract, 50% plus one would have to be disabled veterans to be able to receive a 3% advantage?
That's my understanding, sir.
Any other questions? Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Wilson. Stand by. We have McHugh. Pierre.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is McHugh Pierre, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And we'd just like to go on record as supporting this resolution. We believe this is the right thing to do. We need to reinforce the federal government that when they make their rules, they need to live by those rules, and those rules are very important. Just as other provisions in the law are lived by every day, so should this provision be seen, and especially in Alaska, where we have such a large veterans population and veterans that own businesses. We need to make sure that they have every opportunity they can to achieve success here. And we would really appreciate swift action by the committee, and we appreciate just the incredible support that you and your colleagues have for veterans across the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, McHugh. Representative Brooke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Pierre, you just alluded to enforcement. Earlier this year, as a matter of fact, the first week that session began, I was approached by some vets who were saying that they qualify underneath this program already, and yet it's not being enforced in the state of Alaska. What is available to see that the federal government abides by their own requirements?
Through the chair, Representative Book, I'm sure Tim Wheeler, who is online, he's the president of the Service Disabled Veterans Business Alliance, can speak more to this, but I believe that really it's on the back of our congressional delegation to put the hammer down on these federal agencies and make sure that they live up to their promises to all constituencies, especially these veterans. And by sending these messages, this is really the only way we can ensure that they live up to this promise.
Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, that's not very specific. I was just wondering what entities within the federal government have the responsibility of oversight, and hopefully we'll bear down to those that question when we get the other authorities on board to
and
testify.
Mr. Wheeler is signed up to testify, so write his name down. You can ask him that question.
Yep.
Representative Lynn.
Well, this may be a question for the next fellow to testify, but service disabled, what percentage of disablement is that? The different degrees of disablement. What percentage do you have to qualify? Just any?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, I don't have the specific percentage.
You remind me, somebody I'll ask the next person. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Lynn. Any other questions for Mr. Pierre? Thank you. We're going to go off net right now. Going to go to Fairbanks first and then to Anchorage. We have one in Fairbanks and six in Anchorage. So, Butch Whiting.
Mr. Chairman, this is Butch Whiting, owner of Bighorn Enterprises, LLC in Fairbanks, a service-disabled veteran-owned company, and I am the shareholder and service-disabled veteran that owns the organization. I support HGR 16, and specifically why is because this resolution provides hope. And I represent a new generation of veterans. I am a veteran of Afghanistan and Iraq. I served in both of those areas of operation through a total of four tours, a total of 10 years, 9 months, and 6 days. And during that time, I and many others like me had to shelve our desires to run organizations and enterprises. We made significant sacrifices, and many of those sacrifices are beyond the imagination of most. The end state with this is this resolution provides hope for those that are disabled in the service of their nation. The federal government has recognized that, and now the great state of Alaska hopefully will as well. And this will provide a venue for those individuals, a competitive edge, and not a handout, but at least some inspiration to continue on with their goals and objectives and dreams that they may not otherwise be able to pursue. I hope that this resolution is passed with nothing more, in fact, that there is a significant number of Alaskans that have paid high prices and high sacrifices. Many of them, if they knew that they had an opportunity to pursue work and pursue their dreams, may be so motivated to continue on and pursue what they otherwise thought had been robbed from them. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today and urge you to vote for HGR 16. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Whiting? Thank you, Mr. Whiting. We're going to go to Anchorage, and we will start with Tim Wheeler.
Chair, my name is Tim Wheeler. I'm the president of the Alaska Veterans Business Alliance, and let me just give you a little history. As a service-disabled veteran business, the ownership is 51%, which will classify as a service-disabled veteran. So what I'm saying is the service-disabled veteran has to own 51% of that business to be classified as a service-disabled veteran business. It's a self-certifying program. And if you ever got caught up by the veteran contracting officers, all you have to do is provide your DD-214 and your VA certificate of disability. The disability rating is it can be a 0% on up to 100%. As long as the VA classify you as a disability, you're a disabled veteran. Mr. Chair, I want to tell you two public laws. The first public law was made in June of 1999, which is Public Law 106-50. Is called the Veterans Entrepreneurship Act. And this law created 3% federal procurement goal for service-disabled veteran businesses, and it also is a 3% goal that applies to all prime contracts as well as subcontracts according to the SBA. There is another public law out there. It's Public Law 108-183, and it's called the Veterans Benefit Act of 2003. This law basically enables service-disabled veterans to receive sole source and restricted competition contracts for goods and services used by the U.S. government. October 2004, President Bush signed Executive Order 13360, which mandates all federal agencies to increase opportunities for service-disabled veterans businesses, and still, Alaska is left out. We also have issues of another law that the VA created and passed back in June of 2006. That law is Public Law 109-461, and it's entitled Veterans First. Basically, with the VA, all contracts that are bid out through the VA will go to service-disabled veterans first. If they can't find a service-disabled veteran business, then they will look for a veteran-owned business. If they can't find a veteran-owned business, then it's open competition for everyone. We met, as the Alaska Veterans Business Alliance, met the contracting officer of Veterans Affairs last summer, along with Greg Kaplan, who at the time was working for Representative Don Young. During this meeting, the contracting officer blatantly stated she will not set aside any contracts for the service-disabled veterans or veteran-owned businesses because we can jack up the price any way we want, and she says it's only fair to open up for all competition. This is total blatant disregard of Public Law 109-461 and basically a slam in all of our faces that put our lives on hold for the defense of the freedoms of this country. Mr. Chair, I just want to share with you the public laws, the executive orders that's out there. Nothing is up here working in Alaska. We're not asking for handouts. We're not blaming nobody. We just want the law to be met and just to be followed. Basically, on closing, I just have a question for everyone down in Juneau. You drive around Anchorage, you drive around the Valley, you drive around Fairbanks. You see yellow ribbon stickers, magnetic stickers on back of cars, and it says support the troops. Can anybody ask me or answer this? When the troops come home, put the weapons down, take the uniforms off, why does the support stop? Mr. Chair, I just want to thank you for allowing me the time to testify on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Representative Boot has a question, Tim.
Mr. Wheeler, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate you coming forth on this today. I believe we had conversations earlier in my office. Is that true?
Yes, sir, it is.
Could you state for the record who has enforcement capabilities over enactment of the legislation that you alluded to and the executive orders?
Sir, if I could have Rick Davidge answer that question for you, would that be okay?
That's fine, as long as it's somebody with some knowledge. Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, this is Rick Davidge.
Wait. Any more questions for Mr. Wheeler? Thank you, Mr. Wheeler. Rick Davidge?
Mr. Chairman, this is Rick Davidge. I'm a State Council President for Vietnam Veterans of America, and I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the Alaska Veteran Business Alliance. First of all, the question asked by Representative Book, there is no one specifically identified within the agencies to enforce this other than a self-activated Inspector General report. The congressional delegation has been working with us for almost 2 years to require and to get the federal agencies in the state of Alaska to meet their requirements. Without the congressional delegation, we had no one else to turn to. So with respect to specific enforcement of this, it's a discretionary enforcement within the agencies, and even in the face of the executive order and specifically mandated performance requirements for every agency that were approved, it's really up to the procurement officer and the commander in the particular post that they're located in. That's one of the reasons why we've asked these oversight hearings be held in Alaska, and that the oversight hearings call those specific commanders and contract officers before it to ask them why they refuse to implement the laws. If I could go on with my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Rick.
First of all, as a Vietnam veteran, it's no surprise to Vietnam veterans that our government does not meet its federal legal requirements or even its moral requirements. A lot of Vietnam veterans in Alaska, probably the largest component of veterans in the state of Alaska, is now Vietnam veterans. So we have been engaged with the Alaska Veteran Business Alliance for some time because many of us also own businesses. Let me reinforce what Tim said. 51% ownership by the service disabled veteran, I'm 75% disabled, is all you need, regardless of the size of the company. So I don't know where that information came from, but we can provide you the specific statutory references on that. The main point of this legislation is to get the state of Alaska as a body to simply say, we want action. We reinforce the efforts of our congressional delegation. We're specifically asking the chairpersons of a number of congressional committees to hold a joint hearing here. When I worked for Ted Stevens, we did one of these, particularly with respect to Indian health and Indian housing issues, and it was extremely successful. These hearings held in Alaska with representatives from these four or five committees in Congress would call the commanders and the chief procurement officers for each one of these federal agencies before it and ask them to explain why they refuse or why they have not been able to or what roadblocks are in their way to be able to meet their 3% mandate in Alaska. In Alaska. Let me reinforce that. In Alaska. In closing, Mr. Chairman, this is not only a bill or resolution that's good for service-disabled veterans and the businesses that they own. This is in the best interest of the economy of Alaska, because we're seeing more and more procurement decisions made outside of Alaska which affect expenditures and procurements and activities within the state of Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Rick. Any questions? Russell Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Russell Kell, and I'm the State Service Officer for the Vietnam Veterans of America. Preferences for disabled veterans have existed for years. Those preferences have been diminished in practice. Given the significance of the contribution disabled veterans have made to all, any dilution of preference is unacceptable. It dishonors the obligation we all have. For that reason, I encourage your endorsement and support of HJR 60. Thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Kelly?
Yes?
How long do you have to be on active duty to be considered a veteran?
Excuse me?
How long do you have to be on active duty to be considered a veteran?
Normally, it requires active duty of at least 180 days and an honorable separation from the military. However, there could be some exceptions to that. The actual definition of a veteran, I believe, is still in Title 38, Section 101.
Thank you, Mr. Kelt. Any other questions? Carl Leary?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Carl LeRae. I'm the chairman of the Alaska Veterans Business Alliance here with Tim Wheeler and Rick Davidge on behalf of the Alaska Veterans Business Alliance and its members in support of HJR 16. Simply, sir, what we're asking for, it's critical we have oversight hearings in the state of Alaska as to why the public laws are simply not being followed or implemented in the state of Alaska. We've gone to several federal agencies, just to list a few, the Forest Service, the United States Army, Air Force, Bureau of Land Management, and so forth. And in many of our meetings, we get very tepid response at best. One group has actually come forward and supported us after meeting with us, which is the Corps of Engineers. They've shown support as much as they can do here in Alaska. Again, just to reiterate what everyone has said before me, we have contracting officers that do not feel the veteran business is of any great importance. It's just that simple. And what we'd like with this resolution is for the Alaska legislature to stand with us and say that this is wrong, and it's a disservice to the veteran who's sacrificed himself, his time, and his abilities to go ahead and do honor and service to this country, and then when ready to come back and start a business and move forward in his dreams, his abilities, his wants after his service in the country, to basically just give that opportunity, not a handout, just the opportunity. We have the drive, we have the initiative, we've shown it when we wore a uniform, we want to show it as business owners. So again, thank you all for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Carl. Any questions? John Yomas. Yomans.
He's not testifying, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Barbara Bachmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Barbara Bachmeyer, and I'm an 80% service-connected disabled veteran. I reside and operate a research company in Juneau, but because there was one flight out of Juneau today that was going to Anchorage, here I am. I'm also associated with the Women Serving Women Veterans Group and the Alaska Military Veterans Political Action Committee. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you about House Joint Resolution number 16 this afternoon. By the way, is Representative Olson there?
No.
I saw him at the Juneau Airport. He was going to try his best to get to a phone for this. Sorry to miss him.
Olson.
No, the chair's not here, Barbara.
I understand. Thank you. I know the previous speakers know this, Mr. Wheeler and Rick Davich, but I would like to add just a little bit to the definition that we were thinking about with regard to what constitutes a service-connected disabled veteran-owned business. In addition to what they said, also, that veteran must be fully active in the conduct of the business. So there may have been examples in the past where Grandpa was the service-connected disabled veteran, but had nothing to do with the business. And certainly that would be unacceptable. So the veteran who is on the line to being that service-connected disabled veteran would also have to have a key management function or role. But I think they knew that. We just forgot about it. I join other service-connected disabled veterans having small businesses, veterans organizations, and veterans advocates in testifying today pertaining to the passage of House Joint Resolution number 16. This is an excellent move in the proper direction, but I have further recommendations as to what we might do next. Although I would prefer the use of a stronger word rather than goals in the original federal legislation, that word goal can be fine for our purposes if we can count on federal agencies doing business in Alaska to turn the 3% set-aside goals into tangible reality. Then service-connected veterans will benefit from the original intent of the legislation. We're not doing that right now. In order for all federal agencies doing business here to understand the requirements of the current federal legislation, leaving absolutely no room for potential claims of unawareness or hoping perhaps that their business practices might slip through the cracks, we must have joint oversight hearings in Alaska so that we may publicly review the contractor's performance with regard to how it meets up with the federal regulations and, have them put their record on the line here. If they have wonderful explanations as to why they did not meet that 3% set-aside goal, we'd want to examine those. We'd like to maybe see some documentation, how about some line and block charts, pie charts, whatever, but we'd like to thoroughly analyze why they chose to disregard the 3% set-aside required in federal legislation. The fact is, as others have said already, the federal agencies doing business in Alaska are required to do this, but they're not. And we need to do something to really hold their feet to the fire. So, again, I join the other speakers in just asking you to please pass this legislation. It's important legislation. And later, once this is under control, I'd like us to approach something similar to what Florida is considering, and that is having a state set aside for service-connected disabled veterans. So you can talk to me about that later. I just have one other point that I would like to make, and then I'll close, Mr. Chairman. I have the absolute highest regard for General Eric Shinseki. I served under him while on duty at the Pentagon. President Obama could not have selected a more appropriate person to lead the Veterans Administration into the future than General Shinseki. With that in mind, I'd like you to take a look at the section of the bill or the joint resolution under copies, because I see there that we're actually listing the name of his predecessor, General Peak, and I just want that to say General Shinseki, and I'd ask you to make that change. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Barbara. Anybody else would like to testify, either online or in the audience? Hearing and seeing none, public testimony is closed.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
could you remind one of us to maybe make that amendment?
I think we probably should have a full committee here.
Well, we can't do it. I said that's why I said when the time comes.
Representative Lynn will have that under control.
Thank you. Keeping you under control.
He's a sponsor of the bill here, and a veteran. With that, I think we're going to set this one aside also. I will ask Chair Olson to bring House Bill 105 and House Joint Resolution before the committee as the first two bills that we hear on Monday, when we hopefully will have a full committee and not volcanoes going off and things like that. So with that, we will stand adjourned.